convince the American business community that the war's going to drag on, and they, rather significant power play, they compelled Johnson to start backing off. And one of the things they did was end the trials. But it was serious enough so that my wife, Carol, went back to school after 16 years to get finish up with her a doctoral degree, since we had three kids to take care of. But during those years, although I was extremely active, I mean, there were times when I was giving, you know, 7 talks a day and going to demonstrations and so on, but I always took care to spend as much time as I could, quality time with kids when they were growing up.
So what gives you hope?
Things like what you described. Also the wonderful things in the world of the kind that I mentioned, like my wife.
Professor, world-renowned linguist, dissident, author Noam Chomsky. To hear part one of our interview yesterday, when he talked about Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu's speech to Congress today, you can go to our website. This is just a clip.
Basically a joint effort by Netanyahu and mostly Republican hawks in the United States to undermine any possibility of a negotiated settlement with Iran. Neither Israel nor U.S. hawks want to tolerate a deterrent in the region to their violence.
Noam Chomsky. To hear both of our hours of interview with him, go to democracynow.org. And that does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Nermeen Sheikh, Dina Guzder. I'm Amy Goodman with Aaron Mate for another edition of Democracy Now!
This is Donna with your WUSB. Concert Billboard. Your Concert Billboard for Wednesday, March 4th. Nina Etc. will be at that meatball place in Patchogue, 6:30. The Traveling Macquarie's will be at the Brooklyn Bowl, 8 p.m. Dropkick Murphy's will be at the Paramount in Huntington Village. Jesse Rubin and the Chapin Sisters will be at Deep Wells, St. James, on your concert billboard for Thursday, March 5th. The Rupert Waits Trio and the Folk Goddesses will be at the Batchelor Theater, 7:30. Los Lobos with Alejandro Escovedo will be at the Space in Westbury, 8 p.m. Synchro Saint will be at Barbecue in Patchogue. Punch Brothers will be at the Beacon Theater, Manhattan, at 8.
This is Mary Lamont, host of Down Home Country here on WUSB Stony Brook. This has been your WUSB Concert Billboard announcements. Please check the online version at WUSB.fm.
Hey, how's it going? It is exactly 6 o'clock. No, I'm sorry. It's 6:01 p.m. You're listening to 90.1 FM WUSB, broadcasting from Stony Brook University, from the campuses of Stony Brook University. 6:01 can only mean one thing on Tuesday nights. It's time for Off the Wall.
Thank you.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, here we are at WUSB, Stony Brook.
Is that where we are? Okay, yeah. I wasn't sure, to be honest, but...
And everybody's on campus here, out in the world, on the island, driving in the dusting we're getting.
Oh, yeah, you know, it's great. I'm so happy there's more snow. It's snowing again. It's March 3rd, and it's snowing outside. It was snowing yesterday. All kinds of snow. Snow never stops.
It's a paradise of snow.
It's all snow all the time here. I love snow. I really do, and I'm going to continue to love snow, no matter how much snow continues to fall. So yeah, if this is a challenge, I'm up for it. I'm ready. You know, it can snow until June or July. I don't care.
I like your attitude. I like that spirit. We're all in this. We're gonna get through this.
Oh, look how hard I'm clenching my fist. I'm actually digging into my skin.
Yeah, does that hurt?
Yeah, actually, now that I look at it, it does. Wow, look at that.
Well, we're here.
Yeah, we are. I don't know if we're gonna leave here because, well, I didn't know it was gonna snow today. It was kind of a surprise. I walked outside and said, "Hey, Emmanuel, it's snowing." You know, I actually didn't realize it until you told me it was snowing, and I was walking around in the snow. I was kind of surprised, and it might be slippery going back. In fact, it's going to be slippery no matter what.
Yeah, yeah. So everyone out there, drive extra carefully and do your darndest to get places safely. But if you're in the car, if you're listening to the radio, here we are. We're going to be with you for that enjoyable ride. So
yeah, and most of you aren't within reach of the radio, so you can't turn us away until most of you are here for Finn. I know people like to get in early for Finn because we fill up, you know, on the internet we fill up. There's only a certain number of spaces, and people like to line up early for Finn's show, so they get us sometimes.
Indeed.
That's
indeed
what happens. That's how it all works. We've been busy with all kinds of projects. I've been working on the spring issue of 2600 magazine, the Hacker Quarterly.
Yeah, I saw you. I know you do that four times a year, I think.
Four times. That makes the quarterly. When that happens, sometimes I have to insist on silence throughout a particular area where I'm thinking and putting things together and writing.
Sometimes any area.
Yeah, and it's good when it's over. It's not quite over, but it's really, really close to over. And then I can actually start breathing again and doing other things.
Well, that's exciting. That's good. And amidst many other things, I think there's a lot of exciting stuff going on here at the station, project-wise, improvement-wise.
Yeah, we're building new studios, new mini studios a little bit.
That's what
I heard.
We're
going to be expanding and fixing things and installing things. It's really it's contagious.
Well, there's so many things.
The enthusiasm is contagious.
Yeah, but I think there's a really good group of people here that have the same sentiment as far as maintaining stuff. And
yes,
boy, it's got so much history, and there is quite a lot when you look around. But being in action, coming up with a plan, working with people, that's kind of how, you know, get the dust moved away and you start running cables. And, well, you know, all of a sudden you have a new booth or a new newsroom or a new bit of resources
exactly
that people can use.
And this is what makes radio exciting. People who think that radio is on the decline, you know, certain types of radio, yes, is on the decline. Not this kind. This kind, actually, you can pump up such enthusiasm and do all kinds of cool things. And we've heard so many good conversations on the radio driving around. I heard an interview last Wednesday, which was really cool, of people putting on a play here at Stony Brook. Because Stony Brook is a hub of activity. There are all kinds of things going on. There's fine arts, there's science, there's scientists just half a mile away that are splitting atoms. I don't know what they do exactly, but they really don't like it when you bother them.
They're accelerating them and slowing them down and breaking them apart.
And we've been looking at a lot of programs recently that sort of bring science to the masses, but in a way which is very welcoming. Like the most recent Cosmos episodes, for instance, that aired last year. Just being able to be invited into that world and to listen to what is being said. And, you know, I realize we're kind of in the dark ages in so many ways. And I don't want to give this any more attention than it deserves, which is really very little attention, period. But there are so many people who see science as the enemy. You know, they really, mm-hmm. they view with suspicion what scientists, for God's sake. You know, people actually believe. There are people out there, and unfortunately, lots of them are in positions of power, which is why we have to talk about this at all. But they think that when a scientist says that, yes, we're messing up the environment, climate change, it's happening, you know, you actually had somebody on Capitol Hill in Congress last week, holding a snowball, saying, "Hey, look, it's cold outside. How could it be global warming when it's cold outside?" Idiots like that, and idiots. That is an idiot right there. That is the epitome of idiocy. This is what we have to counter, and it's just we're in the Middle Ages. If we listen to these people, we have to stop. We have to keep moving forward, listening to the scientists and learning and expanding.
I think one of my biggest problems with the way scientists are treated oft is that the cynicism and the disbelief, the concept that a scientist might be trying to persuade, have some bent, they might be biased in one way or another, and I think that gets conflated, and you start trying to equate scientists with this attitude that they're proving something or they're trying to present the evidence to convince based on the action, some entity that they're influenced by. Uh-huh. And really what that is everybody can be influenced or biased. You can have biased or influenced politicians. Yeah, it's possible.
Oh, yeah, think? Absolutely.
So I hate it when politicians conflate that.
What I don't understand, though, is what do they think the scientists are doing exactly? They have an agenda. What is the agenda exactly with climate change? What do they think the scientists... they want to sell us wind power or something, or they've invested in the sun or something crazy like that. Maybe they're just telling us the unbiased truth that, yeah, this is going to look at the numbers. You look at going back into history, millions and millions of years. Yeah, you have to believe that the planet was around for millions of years, too. There's that whole theory of evolution. But the thing is, I think it can all be included. I don't think you have to reject religion. I think the people that blindly do that are guilty too. I think you can be very inclusive of all different belief structures throughout the planet, throughout history, and still embrace science, because it's all a part of the same thing. Our history, our cultures, our beliefs, it's all part of the same story. So you don't have to exclude one for the benefit of the other. So I don't know. We have so far to go, but I just like to hear intelligent conversations and learn more about what this planet. I learned a lot about Venus watching the second to last episode of Cosmos. Mm-hmm. Which, folks, if you haven't seen it, the new Cosmos, not the old one. The old one is great too. Watch that as well. But the new one with Neil deGrasse Tyson, it's incredible to learn so much about the universe, about the planet, about the past, about the future, about microscopic life, single cell organisms. You know, a lot of it goes way over my head, but I still get a sense. I still get a good sense.
Yeah, and I especially love it being made approachable so that, everyday people, young students, everyone can benefit from things that have been sent far away, satellites, all this sort of research and developments. It's exciting news, but sometimes it gets kind of brushed aside. So when you really encapsulate it and package it in something that is approachable, that's when you can really push and change consciousness, and people are aware of, the planet and its orbit and, where that might be in the grander scheme and so on.
We were just driving around Germany not too long ago, twice. We rented a car two different times in our most recent trip. And we see wind turbines everywhere. We see solar panels up on hills. It's the most incredible thing, a field of solar panels.
Yeah, yeah.
And I heard later that Germany has over 70% of its energy is renewable now.
I have a question about that, and it just seems that the attitude's a little different, that instead of resisting the science, they've retooled and created a new industry.
Yes.
Or supported, and in other words, this industry has flourished in recognition, in light of the science.
They've adapted, they've evolved. Yeah. It's, yeah.
Why is it such a monumental shift for us? And I really think that goes to so many different things in this country. Infrastructure, networks, all of the kinds of things.
Well, one of my theories is that we're just too damn big. And we have to try and get everybody on board before we can move forward. And that just slows us down so much. Germany is smaller. Countries in Europe in general are small, so they can tackle something and make it a project and make some real progress. And then the other countries can look at them and say, hey, they're doing pretty good. We should do that too. But in this country, you know, you gotta get Kansas, it you gotta get Mississippi.
It's a big ship.
And good luck getting them to believe that the Earth is round. You know, I'm sorry, folks, but we're really being slowed down by stupidity, and I'm kind of tired of it.
Yeah. Interesting. You're absolutely right. There
I know
is
that makes
a
me a Northeast
there.
Liberal intellectual.
Well, sure. Or a coast liberal, right? You know, you're from one or the other.
West Coast. Come on. Don't include them with us. Oh, I'm sorry. You're from Seattle. I keep forgetting. You act like one of us, Kyle.
The FA Cup.
We do have a very quick update on that. The sixth round proper is coming up this Saturday. March the 7th. I believe that's Saturday. Today's what, the 3rd?
And yeah, Bramford is in there?
Well, Bradford City is from the third tier.
Okay.
We're not following them, but they are playing Reading from the second tier, and Bradford City is the lowest in the eight remaining teams. So six round proper is really like the quarterfinals.
Okay.
Our team at this point is West Bromwich Albion, and they're playing Aston Villa also on Saturday, and that's taking place in Birmingham. We started this back in August when you picked Nuneaton Griff out of the 10th tier, completely at random. You liked the way the name sounded.
Yeah.
And I have to admit, I'm disappointed that they didn't make it all the way. I'm disappointed that they didn't win their match. I'm disappointed that they didn't score a goal. I'm disappointed that they lost by the largest margin of any team, 10-0. But there's always next year. Actually, it's this year now because they're going to start again in August.
Yeah, wow. What a long series.
It really is. And let me tell you something. The winner of the FA Cup, of the hundreds and hundreds of teams that started playing this back in August, the winner gets qualified for the Europa Cup, which basically takes all the teams from all around Europe that have won various championships. Not the Champions League, though. Because if you're in a Champions League, then you're really a champion. You've finished in first place. Actually, you could finish in fourth place in some countries and still make it to a Champions League. But for some reason, the FA Cup, you only make it to the Europa League, which is sort of like a giant consolation prize for hundreds and hundreds of teams.
Okay.
They will qualify for that, unless they already qualify for the Champions League, and then they go to the Champions League. You can't go to both. You can play in both if you get disqualified from the Champions League. If you lose, then you wind up in the Europa League later on. But that's something else. It just keeps getting bigger and bigger is what I'm trying to say.
And the people that have already been pushed out are probably practicing and starting regular games, right? Or will for the next...
I don't know how they... It's like European trains. Somehow they don't run into each other. I don't know how they do, but there's so many of them, and it's so complex. We were in, I think it was Dresden, when we're trying to go someplace, and there's a train on the platform that we got off, and then 3 minutes later, there's another train on the same platform, except it's going in the other direction. And that blew me away. You know, it's going to how could they possibly do it so quickly?
Well, it seems that they overlap. I mean, that they're basically, it's a continuous process, that there is really somehow no overlap in the practice and prep. It's just constant football.
But their football leagues are the same way. Somehow they don't schedule to be playing in two different places at the same time, even though there's no less than four different competitions they could be in at the same time.
That is amazing coordination.
Yeah.
And so, logistics, scheduling.
We're just following one cup, one football association cup in one country right now, and we'll see where that goes afterwards when we have a winner. But yeah, this Saturday, the team to root for America is West Bromwich Albion as they play Aston Villa. Of course, if Aston Villa wins, then we'll be rooting for them in the semifinals. That will take place in April.
Aston Villa, okay, in April.
Kyle, you have a phone call to make, I think. I don't need to...
I do.
I know you schedule a couple of different things at the same time, but...
All right, so I bring this up.
Bring that up and press that button. That's your dial tone. Try not to... You hear that staticky sound? You hear that? That's that horrible sound again. So you need to pick a level and stick with it. Yeah. Kyle, you're calling somebody who's going to be talking to us about rail travel in the United States. We have the president of the NARP, or a high-ranking executive of the NARP, which is the National Association of Rail Passengers.
Yes.
Well, let's see if he answers the phone.
Yeah, let's see if the phone works here.
It's ringing.
Jim Matthews.
Hi there, Jim. This is Kyle from Off the Wall on WUSB.
And Emmanuel from Off the Wall.
I'm joined with Emmanuel. Can you hear us?
I sure can. Can you hear me?
Yeah, you're coming through, and we've got some good levels here. So I want to welcome you to the show tonight, and thank you very, very much for speaking with us on the phone today.
Well, sure, not a problem.
Jim, can you tell us something about what the NARP is?
The NARP is the National Association of Railroad Passengers, and we are a membership organization. We're not industry, we're people, ordinary passengers, and we have been the voice of the American passenger for almost 50 years. We are older than Amtrak.
Fantastic. Yeah, and so what is the primary like initiative behind NARP as it relates to sort of kind of contemporary issues and things going on now? What is your directive? What kinds of things are you doing, and what are the people involved interested in accomplishing?
Well, we look at a lot of things. I mean, back before there was an Amtrak, and then in the early days of Amtrak, our members were really all about saving Amtrak, as it might have fallen apart. And since then, we've evolved, we've grown, what we're looking for now is to try to get folks to understand that our infrastructure in this country is just falling down around our ears. And we need a modern transportation system if we're going to, you know, continue to succeed as a country. You know, you guys were talking about the trains in Germany just before you called me. And, you know, you look all over the world, and there are very, very few countries that don't have a modern train system. Very few. And we are the only, I know it's impolitic to describe first world countries anymore as first world, but we are the only country in that category that has a dilapidated old train system.
Jim, I'm happy to hear you say that, because that proves you're a kindred spirit with what we stand for. But I just wonder if you might have a theory as to why that is. We were in Germany, and we noticed that people there are in love with cars, but they also have trains. Here it seems to be a car versus train thing. Does it have to be that way?
It doesn't have to be that way. And in fact, at NARP, we really believe that if we're going to succeed as a country, it can't be that way, that we reach this kind of tipping point where it's just unsustainable. It's just not going to work anymore. I mean, if you look at, for example, just the look at population, right? We're looking at 400 million people by 2050. How are you going to move those people around? How are you going to have them get from A to B?
Yeah.
You can't just keep adding highways. I mean, we've reached a point where it's killing economic growth. It's adding to congestion, and millions of people are facing the loss of personal mobility. I mean, we talk about flyover country a lot. Well, people don't realize flyover country is getting bigger. There are huge sections of the United States that are just cut off from the rest of the economy. There are places in the United States right now where your only choice is Amtrak or to drive.
Uh-huh.
And there are people who rely on Amtrak long-distance trains to get to and from doctor's appointments. There are, you know, Indian reservations in sort of the Midwest and the upper West.
Uh-huh.
That's it. That's their link to the world, is that long-distance train service. And the more we cut back on air service, which is happening, and the more that we fail to invest in infrastructure, you're getting larger and larger chunks of the country that are just... they're isolated. They may as well be different countries within a country. And then you look at what's happening in the cities. You look at what's happening in urban areas. People are moving back into the cities in huge numbers, and they have to get around too. You know, so you're looking at transit. You're looking at bikes. You're looking at car share. You're looking at all those kinds of things. And so what we envision for the next 50 years is a real, honest-to-God, seamless network that links intercity trains, it links airports, intercity buses, local transit, light rail, cycling, walking, car shares, in just one single seamless network. So you really can get from one end of the country to the other if you had to, without owning a vehicle if you wanted to.
Yeah, that's exactly the kind of thing that we've observed in our travels, and it certainly is. It's about that integration. It's about connecting the regional and local systems, and of course your main arteries across the country, in this case, east-west, and so on. And it's something that I think we wonder what, how can we make this an exciting thing for people? Because when we see in our travels, we see really gorgeous infrastructure, really a lot of money being put into this, and even the money that is talked about in some of these investment acts and stuff. And we'll get to a little bit more of that in a second. But is really on not a, a very large amount on, in when you think of the scale of our nation and the job we have to even increase that standard and the comprehensive nature of our system just a little bit. It seems like we need to somehow get that excitement for building and really putting money into like rolling stock and actual lines and newer higher speed lines like very high speed or high speed rail, as you mentioned before. And I just we wonder what would it take to get that excitement from people that they're living in these cities. They are at the mercy and the effect of systems that could benefit from the money. And I don't know, I just feel like it's something. Rail in particular tends to get the short end of the stick when you have these other modes, and instead of them working in unison so that rail accommodates bicycles and accommodates transfers and local situations and things like that. What we really wanted is the excitement in the population to motivate the states such that when you have a system, and as Emmanuel alluded to, it's a much smaller system in Germany or in Europe, but to get it so that there's a bit of a competitive nature, so that because a lot of what we observe, like in Austria or one country to the next, they have to be on time or else, you know, the Belgian train's going to come. That integration is key. And I really feel like the excitement nationally could be that way. We could be a bit more competitive in state by state and then nationally.
I think you're right. And I'll tell you, I have a couple of thoughts on that. First of all, if you look at, I don't want this to be all about Amtrak, but Amtrak is a good kind of starting point.
Uh-huh.
Amtrak, they've set records for ridership 11 out of the past 12 years. Almost 31 million people took Amtrak last year versus around 10 million 12 years ago. So, you know, people are voting for trains with their wallets. So, you know, there's clearly enough excitement to triple the ridership in a decade. So
yeah.
That's one thing. The other thing is, I've been on the job here as NARP's president and CEO since September. So I came to this only recently, about 6 months ago.
Yeah.
And I spent 7 of my first 9 weeks traveling around the country. I met with mayors and city administrators and planning officials, transportation officials, our own members. And I talked with riders on some of the trains, like the Capital Limited, the Crescent, the Acela, the other services. And one of the things that I found was that once you leave Washington and you visit communities whose trains are a vital part of the economy, or you visit communities that wish they had service or used to have service and don't have it anymore, that whole old red-blue divide fades. You know, in local communities, the passenger train service is seen as a tool of economic development. It's not just a bipartisan rally point, but it's a nonpartisan necessity. I went to the deepest, reddest part of the South and met with the mayor of this particular community. And I started in on my speech about, getting your passenger trains and the importance of passenger trains to your local economy and building it up and so forth. And he put his hand on my forearm while we were talking. He stopped me and he said, "Son, I know all that. How do I get my train?" And really, when you get out of Washington and you start to talk to these folks, there's plenty of excitement in the communities, and really that's one of my big goals in the organization now, is to harness that and get the grassroots pushing up and pushing for the service that they want and they need. I think a lot of people don't know how to plug in. I think they don't know how to be heard. I think they don't know necessarily how to deliver the message to the people who can make a difference. So that's really, our big task, because there's plenty of people out there that I talk to that they want to take the train, they like the train, they take it when it's there and it's available, and we have the same version of this conversation that you and I are having now.
Yeah, that it's not just like...
Where else? Why can't we do that?
Yeah, yeah. Where? What is it going to take to get one of the real new or this type or this style of line or maybe this particular experience I had, it could work here. And I really think that it's in the mindset of... and it's not considered a modern thing in this country, which is unfortunate. It's considered like a nostalgic thing or... You know, and then... To contrast that with what you've just said, that, you know, when you actually talk to people around in these regions and in these parts of the world, they consider it critical infrastructure. So there's a disconnect there with the message.
Jim, can I just ask you, is there anything we can feel hopeful about? Are there any projects that are actually coming to fruition?
Well, I think there's plenty to be hopeful about. I think, for one thing, if you look at California and Texas, actually, I'll tell you, California, Texas, and Florida are all kind of doing some interesting and innovative things in the rail arena. In Texas, in particular, they're talking about a fully privately funded and operated high-speed rail link, and a lot of the universities in the area are behind it, and the student governments are behind it.
Fantastic.
To me, that's really where this is all going to come alive. I think it's you know, students and millennials and so forth who are just gonna demand that this is the way the future is gonna be.
Yes,
because they're not wrapped up in the nostalgia and they're not kind of looking backwards and saying, well, we couldn't get it done for the past 20 years, so I guess we're not going to be able to get it done ever.
Right, blame Amtrak or whatever the attitude is, but absolutely inspiring that cooperation and action to be excited about it and build.
So you said Texas and where else?
California and Florida.
I thought Florida kind of put the kibosh on it. Is that springing to life again?
There's the usual folks who are waving the usual flags, but there's also a lot of political support for the project. It's not dead. It's under attack, but it's not dead. The All Aboard Florida folks are working really hard to open that initial line and get that going. Texas, the same thing. You have people who are putting up, a lot of arguments about how, oh, it's going to cut my farm in half. It's going to do all these terrible things. Well, if you've ridden around in Europe on a train, you can see trains go right in the middle of farms and everything's fine. California... You know, it's been under almost constant attack, and yet they are starting to build lines. And I think that once people see what it's like to ride these trains, they'll get excited.
And I believe there's something also in the Midwest, Illinois area.
They're working on that as well. There are corridors that are being developed all across the country where it makes sense. And, you know, not every market makes sense for high-speed rail. Sometimes you just need better rail, you know, what we call, just good, solid rail. So not everything has to be 170, 180, 200 miles an hour.
Absolutely.
Sometimes just upgrading bottlenecks so that the trains can run at their normal 90-mile-an-hour speed.
Yes.
At 30 miles an hour. That alone can make a huge difference. And everywhere we've seen these investments made, everywhere, you can point to places like Meridian, Mississippi, tiny little place, in North Carolina, you name it, you put in a dollar of federal money and you get up to $3 back in local economic return. It's so important to connect people to jobs. It's so important to connect people to their communities and to give people that option. We've seen it work over and over and over again.
And when well-placed and maintained resources are made available to the populace, they tend to use it. They'll gravitate towards it if it's a good system, if it's new, if there's a community effort behind it. So that's important for us to watch. And speaking of things that are ongoing, I did want to ask about the rail reform and investment situation. That act, I believe, was supposed to be voted on today or moved to Senate today, but I think it's been pushed. Do you have any information about that bill? And are there any things that we should look out for with regards to it?
There's a ton. That's been pushed off to tomorrow. We think somewhere around 1 p.m. What's going to happen is that there is an amendment that has been proposed to the bill that would have authorized Amtrak's funding and some other things too. This, mm-hmm. This amendment, if it gets attached to the bill and it gets passed, it would eliminate all authorized funding for Amtrak over the four-year span of the bill. All of it. Doesn't matter. Long-distance service, Northeast Corridor, the service between, you know, New York, Boston, Washington, state-supported routes, and there are definitely state-supported routes in New York State, in Virginia, in Illinois. All of those would just go away. And it's kind of surprising to us because the person who introduced it, Representative Tom McClintock, his district has two Amtrak-operated trains that the folks there really depend on, the Capital Corridor and service, which is very well thought of as a commuter and sort of regional system, yeah. Plus the long-distance California Zephyr. And so what we're doing, we had 28,000 members across the country, and we mobilized and we've asked them to call their elected officials and oppose that amendment. I don't want just our members calling, though. I want, you know, we talked about 31 million people who rode Amtrak last year. Well, those 31 million, a bunch of them should call their congressperson and let them know, hey, I take the train, I use it, I rely on it. And you know, plus you look at 847,000 commuter rail passengers that rely on Amtrak's rail infrastructure every weekday. Northeast Corridor, a lot of that is Amtrak-owned trackage. We really, really need people to get involved. We need people to pick up the phone and call their congressman. We have a tool on our website that puts in your zip code, and it tells you who your congressional delegation is, and it'll give you the phone number, and it'll also give you some talking points on the bill. And it'll let you send an email to your congressperson as well. If you go to our
Jim, what is your website?
It's narprail.org, narprail.org. And we have a link on the site right now. We have a bunch of stuff on the site. But we have a link on the site right now basically asking people to stand up for trains. There's late filed amendment cuts all Amtrak funding, call now. And under our hotline and blog, you'll find it. And that's where you can click on there and get more information and jump on the email and jump on the phone and make your voice heard. I mean, I look at the midterms and the turnout was dismal. Mm-hmm. Apparently nobody thought much about the election and didn't really feel like it made a difference. And well, here we are only a few weeks into the new session, and it's making a difference.
Yeah, I can see that. Now, this is H.R. 794 people should be opposed to?
H.R. 749.
Oh, 749.
Oh, yeah, and I think I have copied down. It's H.R. 749, and it's this late amendment that is the real concern, and that's actually going to be voted or to move to Senate tomorrow, possibly, I believe, is the current status.
I'm just trying to figure out what is the thinking behind something like this? Why would somebody propose to cut all funding to something that's obviously so vital?
Well, there's a lot of ideological opposition to Amtrak.
Right.
And so a lot of this goes back to really the stealing eyes being out for Amtrak.
Right.
A legitimate debate that can be had about passenger rail in this country and where all the routes should be and who should operate which sections of the routes. But the idea of just blowing the whole thing up is ridiculous.
Yeah, because you're going to get more of the same, and it's inaction. And that's, it's sad to hear. But we're going to definitely watch this. I'd like to stay in touch with you guys. We're excited to have had the chance to speak with you.
Is there anything people can do to help your organization?
They could certainly join. If you go to our website, you can join on our website. What we do is we send you a membership card, and you get our news and our updates, and you also get a 10% discount on your Amtrak travel when you do that. And it's really inexpensive, and we have student memberships too. So NARPRail.org, and sign up, and we'll take care of you. The one thing I did want to just make sure I emphasize, because
sure.
there was a little bit of confusion there, what we're trying to oppose here is that amendment to H.R. 749. We're not super thrilled with H.R. 749 as a bill, but if uh-huh. it passes as a clean bill, we're okay with that.
Right.
It's that amendment that's really, really scary. And so yeah. we're asking folks to vote no on the McClintock Amendment.
Yeah, I had absolutely no idea about that. That's the McClintock Amendment, and I'm really glad that you were able to update us on that. This has been really, really interesting, and I love that you guys are using some technology. That's, I think, critical. We've seen really good infrastructure, but we have other tools and things flourishing in this country that we could leverage, I think, to have more discussions, bring people together, kind of get the right people around the country and in different areas specifically to talk about it, to make it kind of a cool thing again. Because, as you said, it's vital when you actually get on the ground and look at what people have and need around the country. And boy, as travelers, Emmanuel and I have seen all kinds of different infrastructure. I've taken the Empire Builder both ways, actually, last year. So I was one of those 30 million. So anyway, really, go ahead. Yeah.
I was just saying, good for you. That's one of the prettiest rides in America.
Yeah, it really is. It's a great way to meet people, to just kind of watch the scenery, and it's a really different pace. It's a relaxing way to travel. And well, anyway, I could go on and on about the virtues of why trains are enjoyable. But anyway, I want to let you go, and we're going to finish up here. And like I said, we'll stay in touch, and we'll follow some of this stuff on the show, and maybe check in with you guys down the road.
Would love that. Would love that. Thanks a lot, guys.
Fantastic. All right. Thank you. That was Jim Matthews, president of NARP.
National Association of Rail Passengers. I can't believe you said that to him, Kyle. It's down the road. No, down the rail. You don't say down the road to a train guy.
Oh, man, you're right. I'm sorry.
You can never speak to these people again. But I'm looking at their site right now.
Down the rails.
NARP Rail, NARPRail.org. And you can contact your congressperson on that site. And it's really a pretty good tool to have right there. But, yeah, you know, trains, they're so essential. I mean, we're describing enjoyable trains going cross-country because that really is something. It changes your life. It has changed my life. I've learned so much from people about various points of reference and just having conversations.
Hearing about culture. You hear about a good series or a good book or something.
Yeah, I'm not a social person. I don't go out and seek out people and talk to them. I avoid people usually. But on a train, it makes it more interesting. Somehow you become more social and you have all of America passing you by. In a good sense, outside the window. But that's one element of the magic of train travel. Of course, the getting back and forth efficiently is the other, you know, things we see here in the Northeast.
The absolute everyday grind and making that stuff ergonomic, making it efficient and on time and accessible.
We're talking about high-speed rail when we talk about things like that.
Right.
And we haven't even achieved high-speed rail in this country. Overseas, there are many high-speed rail options, but I think Acela is not technically high-speed rail.
And I think Jim spoke and said at one point, he commented on something that you and I've noticed, that our trains aren't actually running at full speed. So even the ones that aren't able to do high-speed aren't running at their full speed.
Right.
So
these are all things that get improved over time.
Sure.
Yeah, it's frustrating now because they built the track so it's too curvy or the train's too wide so it might smack into another train. But these are things that we get past, and then it gets better from that point on. And once you build a rail line, it's there. It's there forever. I mean, look around us. Look at the LIRR. Those tracks have been here since before the country was discovered. It's, you know, these things don't go away unless you destroy them. They're sturdy and they're efficient. You know, and speaking of rail, I heard this about commuter rail, which really kind of blew me away. Commuter rail is something, a whole different animal, but it's every bit as essential and something to be proud of if it's done properly. And in the same breath, I'm going to mention the Long Island Railroad. We are here on Long Island. We have the busiest commuter rail system in the country. But what blew me away was the second busiest commuter rail in the country
is Metro North, which is also New York, you know, and they're both MTA, in fact. And you know what the third most busy commuter rail in the United States is?
Arizona.
No, New Jersey Transit, which also comes out of New York. Now, to be fair, some of it comes out of Philadelphia, but come on, you know, it's mostly New York. Now, if you add all these numbers up, you have something like 100 million annual riders on the LIRR, more like 80 million on Metro North, and a little bit less than that on New Jersey Transit. The one that follows all of that is Chicago with 73. So you have the three in the New York area, and then Chicago pretty much a fraction of that as number four. So, yeah, here in the Northeast, it's kind of we're kind of rail happy, I guess. It's not like that in other parts of the country. It should be. You see all kinds of interesting things if it were.
I'm a little rough around the edges, though, right?
Yeah, yeah. But I couldn't believe that. I couldn't believe that we have the two busiest commuter rail systems here.
That's fascinating. Yeah. That is a lot. And Sounder Commuter Rail out there in Seattle, you are number 14.
Yeah, and just to give you a sense, you have something like 3 million annual riders, and we have something like 240 million.
Look, the Sound Transit, Link Light Rail, it's coming along. You know,
it's not about the numbers.
The Amtrak Cascades, they're all good things.
Yes.
We're going to keep going with that.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, we didn't touch upon China, but they've done a lot with rail over the past, you know.
And a lot of new stuff.
Only a few years it took them.
Yeah, you remember there was, like, a switching scandal? They had used some sort of switching system, and they had an accident or
yes.
something? You remember that? That was a couple of years ago.
That was a couple of years ago, yes.
They're rolling out all these technologies faster than they can develop the things that control them. They're out of control with rail.
Yeah, yeah. hopefully they do it right and they don't cut corners in important places. That's essential. But for the most part, they seem to have succeeded as far as building a network quickly. And we can do the same thing here. All I ever hear is how we can't do things.
Yeah.
You know, in Port Jefferson, which is just to the east of Stony Brook, the village board recently sent a letter to a Long Island Railroad saying they want electrification from Huntington out to Port Jefferson. I used to be against that. I used to be against that because I like the sound of the old diesels going by, you know, and it's just kind of romantic and harkens back to a previous time. But you know what? I'm sick of the 1800s, and it's about time we moved into the 20th century at least. The thing that bugs me, though, is that for some reason we use a third rail system here on Long Island. And Metro North uses a third rail system on some of its trains, but a different kind.
Right.
Which is bizarre.
And this is distinct from overhead, right?
Yeah. Overhead wires, I think, make more sense. That's how every train I see overseas. Not underground, subway, metro, not that kind of thing, but actual commuter trains and high-speed rail, they use overhead wires. It's a lot safer, for one thing. If you happen to be walking across a track, you're not going to step on a high overhead wire.
Yes.
And I think it doesn't get covered in snow quite as easily unless you have 18 feet of snow.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Yeah.
Maybe it's the maintenance part is a little easier, but it's just different, I don't think.
So that's one of the reasons I was opposed to it. But
sure.
It would be nice to have a one-seat ride, as they call it, into Manhattan and a faster one, too, and more trains. Why not? Why is that a bad thing? Why must we all be in our cars all the time? Sitting in traffic. We get bogged down in these things. Anyway, Port Jefferson sent this this letter to MTA, which owns Long Island Railroad, and you know they said, oh yes, we'll certainly consider this. Of course, it would take a very long time and cost a huge amount of, you know, basically it's very very negative.
It's doomsaying, right?
And yeah. I am so sick of that attitude where people just try and talk you out of being idealistic. And just wanting to move forward and do something progressive. And they came up with this amazing figure. You'd be blown away by this. Are you sitting down? You are sitting down.
I'll hold my hat.
$20 million per mile is what it would cost. Now, I don't understand this. I think that's for a single track. A mile, what do you have? You have those wooden planks. Okay, what? The concrete planks now,
I think. To retrofit it with electric?
I don't even know. You know, for $20 million a mile, it should be diamonds, okay, or gold or something like that. But it's metal rails, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't know exactly how to do that, but okay, get a mile of that, two of them, one for each side. Then you get the planks, wooden or concrete, I don't care. And then you get the little wooden thing that covers the third rail. Then you get the third rail itself. Then you plug it all in. $20 million per mile for that? I mean, yeah, I know. I'm absurdly naive as far as what is actually involved with this, but I'm pretty sure that is an incredible amount of money to spend. People in Europe, all right, you're building trains all the time. Since we started this program, a new line has opened up somewhere. How much do you spend per mile for a rail line? Just, you know, a rail line where one wasn't there before. Let us know.
Yeah, I think that there would be scoffing and rolling of eyes if that number was said in front of, like, our fine European counterparts. But, yeah, it shouldn't be that complicated. And it is about being in action. It's about let's build something. Let's, you know, for the it'll never work crowd is always going to be there.
They're always going
to
be there.
They'll be ready to discourage progress. But I think it's about talking to the people and talking to the people that are in action, that are doing things, and getting the people that are in favor of building things and want to be also in action. And that, as you said earlier, is contagious. And we really, for this particular topic, especially because of its critical nature, because it affects so many people, old and young, it's something we want to see happen.
Well, let me ask you, Kyle. Obviously, people listening can't fix this themselves. They need to band together and fix this. And they may feel a little bit overwhelmed that they're not being listened to, they're not being heard, they're not feeling the fruit of their labors.
Like the next day? Or
what can people do on a smaller scale to just get into the mood where they feel they can get something done? That momentum multiplied by a few million people, I think, is really what will be insurmountable as far as opposing it.
I have good answers for this. Me personally, I would say affect some things in your own life, because it gets you into that mode. You have the feeling of success when you've upgraded something or refurbished something or maintained something or changed something around you in your community. So it's good to have small wins along the way.
Examples, any ideas as to what specifically?
I don't know. I don't know. You know, change to LEDs. I don't know. Do something magical. Uh-huh. Build a garden. I don't know. There's plenty of things you can have success with. And maybe work with some other people, but small projects. Maybe it is like advocacy in a small village like Port Jeff or other parts of your region or your area. But I think it's also really important to pay attention,
mm-hmm.
and to express how you feel about it and talk to other individuals that really want to have intelligent discussions. So follow this stuff. It's work to find out when the heck reform and investment, you know, that it's a bit dry sometimes. Yeah, you have to read, you have to pay attention, you have to maybe watch some C-SPAN. I don't know. But
we get very inspired when we're driving around someplace and we see things working. We see those wind turbines going and we see we're going 150 miles an hour, but a train is still passing us. we basically are inspired by that and we try to bring that back with us. And I think there's other ways that people can get that in their lives as well and realize that, yeah, we can do better. We can build things. We can improve upon what we have already.
And acknowledge people and organizations, things around you. Acknowledge when things are well built,
yes.
and well maintained, and when it's working well. I mean, those are critical relationships to build as well. But this is a whole big discussion, and I could go on and on and on.
It doesn't always have to be, and this is what I always learn from reading the comments section, which I shouldn't do of any newspaper. It's always about my tax dollars and how much I'm going to have to pay for the. You're always going to talk yourself out of anything if that is your primary concern. Everything is going to cost something, but you know, in the end, it probably is going to cost the same no matter what. If you are promised a giant return because the county decides to sell 100 acres of wetlands to an industrialist, I'll bet your tax dollars aren't going to go down by more than a dollar. All right, it's not going to make that much difference. Whereas in the other direction, if all of a sudden you have to approve a measure that makes them buy something to preserve it, your tax dollars aren't going to go up by a significant amount either. It pretty much stays in the same ballpark. So you can talk yourself out of these things by thinking that it's going to cost you a huge amount of money, but things balance out. Just watch C-SPAN and you'll see how that works.
And if you go it alone, if you don't get together with people, if you don't if you don't remain vigilant of the process, you're not going to be able to navigate all that. There is, you know, things go badly. There is corruption. There is, you can't just, throw money at something and expect it to be the way you've idealized it. It must be that the people who care, the people that want it to happen, maintain, nurture it, mm-hmm. and grow and deal with the incidental things that are the part of that process, the messiness, right? But the lion's share of that effort will produce something, and move, and that forward progression is the important stuff.
It is like a garden, isn't it?
It's a lot like really germination is. Of seeds. Yes.
Well, just to really inspire us on our way out of here, maybe you could talk about this a little bit. I'm handing Kyle a news article that he handed me before.
All right.
This is something that inspired me, also kind of scared me, but it made me realize, sort of in relationship to the science we were talking about earlier, what we're capable of, what the kinds of things we can do. And yeah, they can be bad things, they can be good things, but they're pretty amazing things in the end.
Okay, so I'm a bit of a photographer. I was looking around and I found a really exciting development just happened. And this isn't actually the smallest camera. There's a type of camera that is non-focus style.
Well, what camera is that? Because that's pretty tiny.
This is the smallest focus camera ever. And basically, it's 1 millimeter cubed. 1 millimeter cubed.
1 millimeter by 1 millimeter.
Yes.
It's a camera.
1 by 1 by 1.
Am I right in assuming it doesn't take film?
It probably does not take film. Okay. No, it's a sensor, a thin sensor, very tiny, and a lens on one side. And it's, if you can imagine, about the size of a grain of salt. And
there's a camera now. A grain of salt can be a camera.
Yeah, in fact, it has a ribbon, like a uh-huh. copper ribbon for the data signals off the sensor, and that ribbon had to be copper because fiber optics are too small.
Too big. Too big, yeah.
It's too small for fiber optics. Yeah. And it's about 250 by 250 pixels. And, you can basically compare it with, like, the point of a needle.
How do you point it? How do you know what direction it's pointed in? I mean, you have to be able to...
Yeah, it's probably going to be on some kind of equipment.
Okay, but these things are good for swallowing and finding tumors and things like that in people, right? That's really what... It's not... having grains of salt everywhere that is spying on us, although that could also be the use in the future.
Well, with IPv6, we could have a lot of these cameras and not run out of addresses for them. So,
wow.
Yeah, you could have a lot of cameras that are a grain of salt. And by the way, cameras right now are a component, okay? That has happened. I talked about this on a radio program we were doing in Salzburg. That happened. Integrated circuits are so small that entire devices of yesteryear are now just components. So you could theoretically build antennas and all kinds of things in a very, very tiny footprint. And the other article I sent was a non-focusing type, and that's actually half the diameter of a piece of hair. And
that's even smaller.
A 50 by 50 pixel array. It's called a planar Fourier Fourier array.
So you're measuring that in microns or something.
And if you can Wikipedia this stuff, but basically this stuff is so tiny now.
Uh-huh.
And
it can't get any tinier, for God's sake. I mean, atoms will be spying on
us. Do you want to know the scariest part?
Quickly.
The last sentence says,
"Scare me quickly."
The extremely small size could make the camera a natural go-to for invasive medical procedures.
But that's good. Invasive medical procedures.
So you can see a brain neuron, or
it's
you know,
not like
all
invasive
these
invasive spying. That's bad. But this could save
but
lives.
Also appeals to security experts.
I'm sure it does.
And one little caveat is that this news story I'm reading is from The Atlantic, March 11th, 2011.
Wait a minute! You're giving me stories that are 4 years old?
Yeah, 4 years ago.
I feel like an idiot now. So I'm blown away by this, and it's 4 years old.
It's 4 years old. So think of how tiny and amazing our old tech is when you're thinking about new tech.
This is one thing that I hate about the internet. They don't tell you dates sometimes on stories.
They don't.
Hey, we've got something to look forward to in the coming weeks, and I think this might be a little preview.
Yes, if anybody's a fan of...
Nothing in particular. You'll know.
Yeah.
We don't speak the name.
Yes, we won't.
What do you want? Gold, women, golden women. Stick with me and you'll have them all.
Every man got a sword and a shield and a knife. Run by the enemy, take away him life.
OTW. OTW at 2600.com. Thanks for listening, everybody. Good night.
Kill the word of the king, no mercy. Show no mercy. Sword well sharp and warriors thirsty. 1 million, yeah, we ready. When the smoke clear, pay a dead body. Yeah, we fight for the king, we die for the king. If a boy say a word, then a straight slaying. 1 million, yeah, we ready. When the smoke clear, pay a dead body. Yeah, we fight for the king, we die for the king. If a boy say a word, then a straight slaying. When you fight for the iron throne and you wear that crown, you're undertone. Don't play around. So when you fight for the iron throne and you wear that crown, you're undertone. And we not play around. There will be no peace till you conquer the beast. Children die, parents weep. Kill another, at the least in this game of throne, your life cheap. Conquer your city, burn it down with fire. 1,000 rise, 1,000 fall. Fire for the traitor, the spy and the liar. We don't care, kill them all. Fight for golden woman, golden woman. That them a fight for. Yeah. All right then. When the smoke clear, we are gonna see who's standing. When the smoke clear. When you fight for the iron throne and you wear that crown, you're under town. Don't play around. So when you fight for the iron throne and you wear that crown, you're under town. And we not play.
Yeah, kids, Finn with you. Finn's Revolution until 9 p.m. right here on WUSB Stony Brook. Tonight, we're going to be speaking with Ryan Baca of the fantastic, fantastic band Wake Up Lucid from L.A. And we're going to be giving away some tickets extremely shortly to Los Lobos and Alejandro Escovedo this Thursday night at the Space at Westbury. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. Yeah, kids. That, of course, was Wake Up Lucid, who we're going to be talking to Ryan Baca in just a few moments right here on WUSB Stony Brook. And Ryan is from the band Wake Up Lucid, a real kind of like, I guess you call them gutter rock from L.A., a real great, messy, fantastic rock and roll operation. And yeah, so we're going to be talking to him in a couple of minutes right after this tune, I do believe. This is from their brand new record, Gone with the Night, and this is called Let It Roll right here on WUSB Stony Brook.
Same as before.